Hey everybody, how's it going? Welcome back to the History of Video Games. My name is Wes, and I'm here, as always, with the wonderful Ben. How you doing today, Ben?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you, Wes?
I am doing great. You know, we're on our second episode of 1981, and we just finished our 1981 research. You know,
yep.
Just in the nick of time, but man, I'm feeling good. I know you are, because you were pulling most of the weight on that research.
Well, you definitely helped out. I mean, you know, I appreciate all the help you had. I was like really nervous about our final game count though, because I didn't know where it would land.
Right.
It landed right at like 670 mentions and reviews we're going to do this year, which is actually less than the last 2 years. So we're just focusing on those really great games, man, but it's still a lot of games. So.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, of course, it wouldn't be our podcast if we didn't want to mention all the weird stuff, all the incremental stuff that builds up improvements and innovations as we go. But there was a lot more stuff that we're like, we don't need to hear about that. So it's going to be a lot more good stuff for sure.
Oh, yeah.
But with that being said, I'm curious to know, what have you been up to recently in your modern current day gaming adventures?
Well, actually, I think I have to go back and talk about a game I played a while ago, because yeah. I didn't play like anything this week. I was too
researched. We've been doing a lot of research, yeah.
Too into the research. So a game I played a little bit ago, and I'm planning on going back to it, is a game that I think you're going to really like eventually, like once it's all done, and I'm sure you'll get it eventually. It's a game called Traveler's Rest.
Oh, okay.
And, this game, it has a lot of Stardew vibes. It's in a pixel style, and it's really nice looking and has a style to it that reminds me of Stardew. The main idea of this game is that instead of being a farmer like in Stardew, you're running an inn. And to run the inn, you still have to do farming to get like ingredients to make dishes. But you also, there's a whole like brewing system, like a four-stage brewing system process that you have to work on. And then there's also a bunch of crafting to make new tables and decorations and all sorts of stuff. It just recently got a new update that added farm animals, but I haven't played that update yet. But it's pretty good. I feel like the crafting system, and there's like it's like a talent tree of unlocking new recipes and stuff. That whole system is really cool. And I was really enjoying unlocking the next recipe or, I don't know, different form of table or high chair or something. I don't know. But I really enjoyed how much of a progression system was in the game. I wasn't expecting that. Like in Stardew, I feel like there's not really much of a progression. It's just like, just your tools, maybe, you know, from like bronze to diamond or wherever it goes
right.
up to.
Yeah.
But in this game, it felt like pretty much every system from the farming to the crafting to the cooking and the running of the business had upgrade systems. And I was like, okay, that's pretty cool. You can even, just like in Stardew, you can expand how large of a room is when you go inside to run your restaurant. You know, get more tables in there. Unlock like the cellar or the attic and stuff like that. So I really enjoyed those systems. There's stuff going on outside of your main screen, which is kind of just a road, and then you're in on the road. So you can go to some other places in the world, but they're not really built up yet because the game is still an alpha. So you kind of go to these other areas and there's like nothing to do there, but there'll be like an interesting set piece in the background. You're like, okay, something is going to go here eventually, but not yet. Or like, I had a neighbor who was like moving into his new house, but he like never finished moving in. Like whenever I saw him, he's just like, yeah, I'm still moving in. You know, talk to me again once I'm in, once I'm settled. Like he never did it. So I think it, you know, maybe wait a little bit more dev time. It is getting like amazing reviews and a good reception, so I'm very hopeful that they're gonna have plenty of time to make it as good as they want. But I really enjoy it so far. Really nice art style, good progression systems. The restaurant gameplay is really nice. there's a couple main mechanics with it that reminds me of like a Diner Dash or something. It's not quite as fast as that, but basically a person comes in, they have an order, and you have to grab whatever entree or drink that they want and deliver it to them. They'll go sit down on themselves, like by themselves, and then you have to clean the tables or the floor, which got dirty after a certain amount of time. And also there can be rowdy customers and you have to grab a broom and hit them out, which is awesome. So I really enjoyed it. And it's kind of interesting. You can basically go between running your inn and doing the crafting, and kind of you can open and close the inn whenever you want. So basically I just did it maybe for a portion of the day every day, but I didn't have to. I could have left it closed. I could have ran it the whole day and made a lot of money. But it's all just what you want to do. There is a day-night cycle, and you have to be at bed at a certain time. So it's pretty fun.
Cool.
Yeah, I enjoy it.
There's
already
awesome.
A lot to it, and I'm going to follow this progress and play the new update as soon as I can, probably this weekend.
Nice. And is it like medieval setting or is it modern?
It's like I guess medieval setting, yeah.
Okay. Or like a D&D kind of setting, like.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what you would call it. To me, it's almost like pilgrims or something.
Okay, interesting.
Huh. Yeah. Because there's like definitely some technology, like there's forges, right? And stuff like
right.
a big like a sawmill. Is that the right word?
Yeah.
Like, you know, some electrical powered like wooden saw, but people aren't dressed like current day. They're dressed like fantasy somehow.
Interesting.
It's an interesting art style, but it works.
Yeah. No, that sounds really cool. It's definitely something I'm going to keep my eye on too. Although, maybe I'll wait till the full release since you'll be giving me updates on the alpha.
I think they do have a roadmap. So
cool.
I'll follow that and let you know what's happening.
Nice.
But what have you been up to, Wes? Hopefully something more current.
Well, slightly more current. Last weekend, I got a new game to play with a couple of my friends that I've been keeping my eye on for a while called Avorian. I don't know if you've heard of this one or not, Ben.
How do you even spell that, Wes? What is that?
A-V-O-R-I-O-N, I think. So Avorian, I don't know how you say it, where the emphasis is. But it's a space game, sort of blocky voxel graphics kind of game. And one of the big things that got my attention is that you start out in this little drone, you mine resources, and then your next step is, okay, build a ship out of those resources. Almost like Space Engineers, where you have blocks and you're just constructing a ship. Like, they do have presets that you can buy from different space stations, but you can just make it look like whatever you want. And that is a lot of fun, although much more complicated than I anticipated. Your ship starts with crew on it, and apparently they need crew quarters, and apparently you need power to run a ship. I didn't know all that stuff, but so there's definitely a steep learning curve to it. But as I mentioned, I got it to play with friends, which is great because you can, it seems like, in the current game, seamlessly just start a game, say, host to multiplayer, and then have two of your friends join and play in a world, like a persistent server that then gets saved and it turns off when the person hosting turns off. But I was just expecting to have to jump through hurdles to play on a on a server in this huge galaxy and have it actually work. So you can actually play with your friends. You can join an alliance so you can pool your resources together. And if the shipbuilding wasn't enough, what really I think is going to get me to stay into this even longer is that, let's say you build a ship, you mess around with it for a little bit and you're like, I want to try something new. You can go to a space station, pay for a captain to captain your ship. And then now you can give orders to that ship to do things while you're off in another ship, exploring another part of the galaxy. So we are still just very much on the periphery in our playthrough, but it seems like you can have whole fleets of like miners with fighter escort ships stripping the galaxy of all of its resources while you're off gallivanting towards the galactic core, you know? And it took a while to figure out, but the actual like ship management aspect of it there's even like a strategic view when you're in a star system that's almost like Homeworld, the RTS, where you're controlling ships and fighting each other. So you can actually like command your units and fight enemies and all that. It just seems really cool. The thing that I've yet to see is what the enemies are going to be like, if they're going to be compelling, if it's just a player versus computer thing, or if the game is really best as like a PvP type of game. I'm not sure. But either way, I'm excited that you can, you know, make a trading ship, get a captain who's good at trading, and then just have passive income on the side. Like, I'm super excited to mess around with that stuff. So it's a really cool game. I'm still just scratching the surface on it, but it's definitely one to check out.
Cool. That does sound pretty cool. I was looking up some pictures of it. It seems nice.
Mm-hmm.
But with that being said, Wes, let's move into what we want to actually talk about today. We're so hyped about these 1981 games, and actually going to be finishing January today, if you can believe it. So I'm hyped for it, but before we hit the games, I want to know a little bit about kind of a new company for us. We have seen them in the periphery, mm-hmm. but they're going to start coming out with a little bit more important games. So why don't you tell us about VTech, Wes?
Yeah, so VTech, they are the creators of a game that we are going to be playing in the timeline today. And they're a company that actually started in Hong Kong in October of 1976. So in the scheme of things, they're still a pretty young company, although it seems like they're expanding pretty fast. The original name for the company is Video Technology Limited, which is where VTech came from, although it's been shortened over the years. And when they were first founded, they actually started out making home Pong consoles in 1977, which is probably how we sort of heard of some stuff that they did, but we weren't really interested in, I'm sure, at the time. But then from there, they moved to creating LED handheld games, which they sold to Radio Shack for distribution. So I'm not even sure if we mentioned any Radio Shack handheld stuff, but some of it may have been developed by VTech. But then after doing that for a while, and I think kind of establishing themselves, getting practice and figuring out what they wanted to make, they started to make and brand their own products, including handheld games, which is what we're going to be talking about today. A lot of the early stuff they made was geared towards learning. One was called the Lesson One, and it taught spelling and math. That came out in February of 1980, and it was their first electronic learning product. But that's actually a theme they're going to carry through their whole history, even to current day, when they're still making electronic learning products, and I'm pretty sure still in business today. But what we wanted to talk about is the handheld, not necessarily educational games that they made. And it's pretty much general consensus that these were a direct response to Nintendo's Game & Watch. It's not too hard to see when you look at the name of their line, which is called the Time and Fun. Even has like a similar something and something kind of naming structure. And they are basically different Game & Watches, but they're interesting and they're not exactly the same and they're not exactly the same games. So we were definitely interested in checking out some stuff in that format. And the Time and Fun line goes on for a while, and I think it's kind of generally regarded as one of the better sort of copies or interpretations of the Game & Watches. So today, as I mentioned, VTech is still around. Apparently their main business is cordless phones, which, you know, you would think in the age of cell phones aren't super popular anymore, but I guess some people are still using them. And they're still making a lot of electronic learning devices and toys. And it looks like they might make a console later in their in the video game history too. Not sure if it's going to be anything we'll be interested in, but either way, we're going to have to keep our eye on VTech because they might be coming out with some cool stuff in our video game timeline. And that's pretty much all I had on VTech. Unfortunately, they kind of dabble in video game history for a little bit, but then go back to cordless phones.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, that's still pretty cool, though. I just noticed Time and Fun. I wonder if time refers to the fact that these can be used as like a watch again.
Oh, yes.
Because Game & Watch is kind of like that.
Absolutely, yeah.
So they even stole the clock part.
Yeah, and as far as all the ones that I've checked out, they're the exact same thing, where it's like, this is a video game and a clock, which is literally like the Game & Watch's whole thing. So
yeah,
it's hard to deny that this is a ripoff of Game & Watch, but hey, if they do a good job with it, still definitely an interesting thing to check out.
All right, well, with that being said, though, let's head over to the timeline and check out the first game.
Hey everybody, welcome back from that brief little break. Let's hop right into our games today and start off with the VTech game that we were talking about and mentioning in our special topic. The first VTech handheld game that we want to talk about is called Monkey, and it's also my first review of the episode. So as we were going through these, we unfortunately didn't have any month dates for the Time and Fun series by VTech and when they came out during 1981, but Monkey does have the lowest or like the first numerical serial number. So while that doesn't necessarily mean that it came out first, it makes the most sense to us and nobody else had any other information. So that's pretty much how we're going to be organizing them. And that's why we end up with Monkey in January of 1981, even if it may not have come out exactly then. This one is a pretty cool looking handheld, actually. It's got nice colors on the box. And it has cool palm tree and grass overlays on the screen, which, as far as I can remember, I don't think the Game & Watches have done yet. Or if they have, they've been pretty minimal. I don't know if you remember in particular, Ben, but yeah.
I think they've just had black and white overlays, maybe. I don't think they've had color up until now.
Yes, yeah, I think you're right. But this, yeah, it's, you know, full color. There's green grass, there's palm trees, and the coconuts are digital, but I'll talk about that later. It just looks really good. And as we mentioned in our special topic, it does have the clock functionality, just like the Game & Watches. So it's very much VTech's Game & Watch, the Time and Fun. But getting into the gameplay for Monkey, I would say comparing it to a Game & Watch, it's probably most similar to Vermin or the Exterminator, as it's also called. But instead of whacking moles with a hammer in each hand, instead you're fending off monkeys with a bat. Just one bat. You don't have one in each hand. your character is, for some reason, hiding in the top of a palm tree. It's not like you're another monkey. Like, you're just a dude who's sitting up there. And then these cute, adorable, totally harmless monkeys are climbing up three palm trees on the screen, just trying to eat and get coconuts. But your job is to whack them and make sure they don't steal the coconuts. So you can kind of hit to the left, hit in the center, or hit to the right to get the three different palm trees. And that's basically it. I mean, it's very much like Vermin, like a timing game. Once you get to the later parts and they start going a lot faster, you have to say, okay, that one was first, so I hit him first, and then you hit them all in quick sequence. And that's pretty much the difficulty curve of the game, remembering the order that they popped up so you can hit the closest ones first and still have time to hit the other ones. That's the general gist of the game. You're hitting the monkeys off the trees and trying to stop as many as you can. It may depend on the settings of the game. It seemed like there's two different game modes, but I think the monkeys can steal about 10 or 12 coconuts before you lose the game. There's a little counter in the top right that shows up every time they successfully steal a coconut. So that's pretty much it. The two game modes, I don't know exactly what they do. They may control how many monkeys or how many coconuts can be stolen. They may also be the starting speed of the monkeys, which I think is more likely because I'm pretty sure that's what Vermin did. It was just it starts faster. It's a pretty simple game. You know, it's a Game & Watch style handheld, so there's not too much more to say there. So let me get into my ratings and I can talk about this game a little bit more. For graphics, I gave Monkey a 2.5 out of 10 because I think it looks way better than the Game & Watches that we've seen so far. The overlay, even though that's not quote-unquote digital graphics, I think looks fantastic, and it really helps provide a setting without having to render it digitally in black and white And it allows for really cool things because it's sort of under the screen in a weird way, or the digital images can be displayed on top of it somehow. But it allows for this nice effect where the grass on the bottom, which looks like this really thick grass in the jungle, they have just the monkey's head show up at the bottom of the screen, and it really looks like they're popping out of the grass to jump up the trees. So it looks great. The monkeys themselves look adorable, which is why I really feel like we're the villain in this case. There's, I think, like 5 different sprites for them coming out of the grass and climbing up the tree, which are all look really good. And I believe some of the sprites are slightly different depending on which tree they're climbing up. And it also includes them reaching for the coconuts at the top, which is the last chance you have to hit them before they steal the coconut. They also have a special sprite or little like image for when you hit them and they fall down, with like a little comic book blam symbol under their butt as they fall on the ground, which is pretty funny. And thankfully cute too. Like if they had X's on their eyes, I don't know what I would do. I wouldn't be able to play the game. Your character though is just kind of weird. Like he just looks like some jerk who...
He kind of looks like a police guard with a baton.
He does. He does look like a traffic policeman, or just like a police guard with a baton. And only half his body is showing because he's like coming out of the palm tree and he's just hitting these monkeys. So I don't know. It doesn't even look like he has a safari hat on or anything. I'm not sure what's going on there. I do also appreciate that the coconuts on the trees are digital, though, because there's sort of a bunch of coconuts at the top of the tree when nothing's grabbed them. But when a monkey makes it and successfully steals one, it shows just like one coconut in his hand and all of them have disappeared off the tree. It's a little thing, but it's a nice effect that kind of makes like, oh no, they stole the coconut, more exciting. Moving on to sounds, though, this is pretty similar to the Game & Watch, unfortunately, not really much better. So I only gave it a 1.5 out of 10 here. It's still just those simple beeps with different pitches, but as with the Game & Watch games, it does have this nice alternating effect when there's like a lot happening on the screen at once, kind of like a pinball machine or an arcade machine, where it just has that nice feel to it, even though it's really simple when the game's getting hectic. Moving on to gameplay now, I gave Monkey 8 2 out of 10. While I really like the theming and the design, I think the gameplay might actually be a little less interesting than some of the Game & Watch games. Instead of having 2 hammers and 5 spots that you have to watch, like in Vermin, you only have 3 trees and 1 bat. So, you know, just lost a little bit of complexity there, but still, it plays really smoothly, it can get really fast. And I think it could be pretty addicting, and it's just kind of a nice little way to pass the time, especially for a handheld, which really I feel like that's what they're trying to do. For relevance, I gave it a 6 out of 10 because, you know, they're really just riding the Game & Watch wave. But I think these are significant because the VTech is, with their Time & Fun series, is adding their own ideas. Obviously, this is similar to other games, but this isn't a direct copy. It definitely has its own feel. And even though VTech isn't a huge video game company by any means, it looks like they're going to keep this line going for a while, and this is the first of that line. So I think that's pretty cool, and hopefully it does fairly well. And so overall, for Monkey of the Time & Fun handheld series, that left me with a 2 out of 10. It's fun, it's simple, which is really all you want from this type of game. It really looks good with that overlay, and I think that helps the game out a lot. And I'm just really excited to see what other type of weird games they come up with. I mean, it feels like Nintendo went straight for the really weird stuff with like people jumping out of a building and you have to bounce them into the ambulance. So who knows what VTech is going to do.
Yeah. Luckily, I know a little bit because I did the research for VTech 81. And I'm really excited about it because I feel like VTech becomes such a competitor that, like, right now for Monkey, okay, they're just kind of copying Game & Watch stuff. Mm-hmm. But eventually they do stuff that's so unique that I feel like Game & Watch starts to copy VTech on certain things. So they really kind of trade blows when it comes to the best games, I think. Cool. And I'm really excited for some of the other ones to come out. I saw some pretty good ones. So, yeah, this will be fun. Fun company to watch. especially in the handheld space for 1981, it's going to be dominated by VTech and Nintendo, I think.
Yeah, good for them.
Then. Everything else is like red LED dots that nobody cares about.
Exactly, yeah. It's good for them to have some competition, though, you know, because hopefully that breeds innovation.
Yeah. Game & Watch certainly comes out with quite a number of games this year as well, Wes. Don't you worry.
Oh, boy.
All right, but I think we're good with that for now. That was the only handheld that we wanted to mention for January here in today's episode. So let's move on to some magazines. There's a little bit of cleanup we have to do. I found a magazine called Practical Computing that went back, I think, till like 77. That I don't think we've ever talked about on the podcast. I didn't know it existed. It does happen from time to time. And I looked through every magazine from like 77 till now to see if there was anything interesting in the magazine. And there were some interesting games. For example, back in December of 78, they had a game called Labyrinth by Sean McHugh in Practical Computing. And it was a top-down maze game where the player could use spells to defeat monsters, open doors, climb stairs to different levels, and find treasure. So it sounds like kind of a whole little RPG in a magazine in 1978, which is a long time ago. So I thought that one was cool.
Yeah, and then in their December of 1979 issue, they had a game called Star Traders by QJ North. We don't really know if this was a straight-up ripoff of the original Star Traders by Stephen Faber, but it's really big. It takes two programs to run, and it's 7 pages of typed-in code in the magazine. So it must have something going on. It's a space trading game that recommends around 6 hours per game and could offer up to 12-player support. So I like the multiplayer option there.
Yeah. And that's a pretty big type-in game. I wouldn't want to do that.
No, I know.
You go to launch it, and it's like error, and you're like, oh, God. What did I misspell? But there's one more here. Practical Computing for July of 1980. There's a game in this issue called Super Tank by Bob Mary, and it's an asymmetrical war game where you deployed various missiles and artillery against a computer-controlled super tank in a kind of turn-based strategy game style. It sounds pretty cool, but we don't have many like visuals or video of it to tell exactly what it looked like. But I do kind of like the idea of you deploying all of your forces against a super tank. That sounds cool.
Yeah, for sure.
And interestingly, I don't think Practical Computing had any games of note for 1981. So we're only mentioning them this year for old games.
Yeah.
But that's okay.
I mean, it's only Practical Computing, Ben. That's only a video game every now and then.
I mean, I have to say, typing in 7 pages of code is not practical.
Very true. All right, well, let's move on to a few more magazines here. Next up, we have a big list of magazines, including some that we usually got some interesting games from, but all of the ones I'm about to list have nothing of note for all of 1981 somehow. Mm-hmm. So that is...
We were harsher this year, to be fair.
But... Yes, yeah, and you know, just TRS-80 game that has okay graphics isn't going to cut it anymore, along with other stuff. So those magazines that didn't have anything of note for 1981 are Soft Talk Magazine, Ace Newsletter, Apple Orchard, which is a new quarterly magazine, Byte Magazine, Dr. Dobbs Magazine, the Computer Gaming World Magazine, Personal Computing, the Paper Mag, which was a pet magazine, Analog Computing Magazine, Killabod, which I love the name, so I'm always sad when they don't have good stuff.
Yeah, they're a pretty general magazine.
Yeah, same with Byte, who is another big one. Just a lot of general electronics and software kind of stuff. And then Rainbow Computing Magazine, Tansoft Gazette, 80 Microcomputing Mag, Microcomputer Printout Magazine, Personal Computer World, Chromaset, which was a new magazine by the C-Load people for the TRS-80 Coco, so we were excited about that one, but unfortunately nothing too good there. Computer and Video Games Magazine, amazingly, nothing for good video games for 81.
Just some backstory about that one. I think we're going to do that one in a special topic, I think, actually. But it came out in November, so they only had two issues.
Oh, that's right. So we may be seeing more from them in the future. Mm-hmm. And then, as Ben mentioned, Practical Computing and Micro Magazine.
And the reason we wanted to list all those out to you guys is because we actually read every single one.
Yeah.
So that was like 100 hours of work we just read out there.
Yeah. And it's not for nothing, because even though those had nothing in them, there's plenty that did have interesting things in them. Yes. So it's always worth checking.
Yeah. And we actually get a lot of our special topic ideas from magazines as well. So we're definitely going to bring them up again throughout the year. There are two magazines I wanted to mention quickly that I don't know if there was anything of note in them because they're paid walled. So these two companies, I guess, still exist today, and you have to pay money if you want to see these old magazines. One is called Call Apple, and the other one is called Nibble Magazine. So I don't know if there was anything interesting in them or not.
And then we have a couple foreign language magazines here, which, even though there are great translation services when it's coming off of a PDF that has been scanned and it's just somewhere on the internet, it's not really possible to translate these. So for a lot of them, we couldn't read them. So there's Elector and Elector magazines, which are German and Dutch versions of that magazine. And then Micro and Personal Computer Mag, which was a Spanish magazine. And then ASCII magazine, which was a Japanese magazine. As I mentioned, all of them either we couldn't read or there was nothing of note in them.
All right, but let's move out of magazine land. Let's head into some computer games with the first one I reviewed today. This one is just a for fun one, you know? Like, I knew it wasn't going to be good, but I just thought this is kind of fun. It's a game called Roach Hotel by Microlab, and it's an Apple II game that came out sometime in 1981, and it's a game where the whole thing is about you stomping roaches, and I feel like I'm pretty down with that, Wes.
Yeah, yeah.
I could stomp some roaches. So, you know, it's not going to be great. I'll just put that up front. The whole game, you're kind of at the top of the screen and kind of move around like you would in Space Invaders or something. Except when you fire your weapon and it goes down the screen, because you're at the top in this case. Like your ship, if you would, looks like a foot. So you would think when you fire, the whole foot goes down, right? And like maybe you just have a really long leg or something. But when you fire, instead, it like the shoe of your foot just detaches from the leg and flies down. And that's how you stomp stuff. You just like shoot shoes at the enemy roaches. The roaches don't attack you or anything. The roaches in the middle of the screen, there is an actual hotel. And the roaches come in from the sides of the screen and try to enter the hotel. And I guess when the hotel fills up, you lose. So they're just kind of running towards the center of the screen, which kind of reminds me of a different Space Invader game where invaders came from the sides of the screen and were like abducting people from the middle. But here the roaches just go to the middle and then they're in the hotel. And then you also have another enemy that's a spider enemy, and that one will come up and try to like get your leg. So you either have to, you know, stomp it before it gets to you or just dodge it. But that one's like a more legit enemy. Something that I thought was really cool but really weird, like if you stomp the spider, your foot attack projectile will continue and also hit a roach, so you can get a 2-for-1 kill, which is pretty cool. But weirdly enough, if you hit a roach, your foot will stop. So if there's two roaches, one underneath the other one, you only kill one. And I feel like your foot should continue to go down through both of them. I don't know. If it does that for a spider and a roach, why wouldn't it do it for two roaches? I don't know. But it feels like when the game gets quote-unquote harder, it's more just like two roaches spawn in at the same time, but your shot projectile fires pretty slowly. So you fire once and then it kills the top roach, and then you go to fire again and the other roach made it in the hotel. And you're like, come on, I couldn't have done anything about that. But maybe there's some weird roach strategies I don't know about. But that's pretty much what the whole game is. I just thought it would be kind of a fun, easy one. And there's not a whole lot of great games in January. So I thought, well, we've got time for it. Let's do it. So these scores aren't going to be great, but I did enjoy playing it. For gameplay, I had to give it just a 2.25 out of 10. There's no like new waves or a boss character or anything. There's two different types of roaches, but there's just a different like sprite of them. And they don't do anything. They just run to the middle of the hotel. The spiders always act the same. They kind of do a diagonal dodge up towards your foot, but they're pretty easy to either hit or avoid. I actually kind of stopped playing the game for a while and just let it run because I was just killing things too fast. So it's a really easy game. I was just waiting for it to kind of end by the time I was finished with it. So the difficulty is not very good. When it does get harder, it's not a fair harder. It's like, okay, there's just three roaches on screen, but I can only fire two boots by the time they get to the middle. So I guess I just am slowly losing. So, you know, it's not a good game, but I liked the concept of it. I really liked having my foot detach from the leg and fire down at roaches. That was the best part, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
And something else that I didn't mention, so at the middle of the screen is the Roach Hotel, and that's like where the roaches go to be safe. So because of that, if you fire your foot at the Roach Hotel, it'll hit the roof and then fall off the roof diagonally and then alongside the building. So there's like some sort of collision with the roof of the hotel, which is kind of cool. I wasn't expecting that. So yeah, I mean, it's okay. It's not great. It's good for like 5 minutes of fun, I think. For graphics, I had to give that like a 2.5 out of 10. There are some color graphics here. It's on the Apple II, and we do have some oranges and blues on the Apple II, which we don't see super often. We have the usual like green, purple, white situation, but the blues and the oranges make a nice appearance. Your boot looks really weird. It's like white, so it kind of reminds me more of like a sock, like some sort of old white athletic sock or something. But still, it totally works. The squish animation, or like the death animation of the roaches, is pretty nice. It's kind of a big splat, and the spiders have the same splat. So I think overall it looks pretty good. Like, I didn't have any complaints about how it looked. Maybe the fact that there's two roaches, and I don't think either of them really look like roaches. They kind of look like shrimps or something to me, but the spider definitely looked like a spider, so... And I guess the hotel does look like a building. It has like windows and stuff. So, you know, it's not great, but it's all right. For sound, I mean, there's really not a lot of sound here. It plays the Charge theme when you start the game, which is a weird choice, I think. And then I think it just makes a sound when you squish stuff, but not when you fire your foot. So I don't know what that sound would have been anyway, but it's a pretty quiet game. So I couldn't go high for the sound. There's no music playing when you are actually playing the game. So just a 1.75 there for sound. For relevance, I gave that a 2.5. Nobody knows that this game exists. If it wasn't on archive.org, this would have been lost. I don't think it's on like even like a Moby Games database. Like, you can't find this game. It's hard. But this is the kind of like nice little hidden gem that we like to find. It's so weird, and it's just a fun time that I wanted to cover it. So, but nobody's gonna know about this game. So
right.
for that, and it's obviously not breaking any new ground, but. So I just gave it 2.5 out of 10 for relevance. And overall, that left me with a 2.25. It wasn't horrible. Like, I enjoyed it. But, you know, I knew going in it wasn't going to be game of the year. So it kind of lived up to what I was expecting. Some weird stuff. You know, your foot being fired and chopped from the leg, and then you get a new foot again. That's pretty cool. That's what I was looking for when I was ready to stomp some roaches. So I was pretty happy with it.
It's what the people want, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds great. I mean, that's, yeah, like you said, not going to be the best game in the world, but gotta love some weirdness when you're like, they probably made this decision just because they couldn't program it any other way, but the foot flying off is hilarious.
Yeah.
Very cool.
All right, but your next one, though, Wes, it's a little bit more serious, I think. I don't know.
Yes.
But that's my feeling about it.
It is, for sure. It is an Eamon adventure. Which, for those of you who don't remember or don't know, Eamon is a series of like RPG text adventure games, but the defining characteristic of them is that you have a main hall program, a sort of like tavern program, where after each adventure you go on, you can sell all the stuff you got from that adventure, use it to buy new armor, level up your character, learn spells, and then continue adventuring with the exact same character. So that is part of the awesomeness of the Eamon Adventures, and one of the reasons that we like to take a look at them. Unfortunately, though, the ones this year didn't really look too great. So this is the only one that we are going to be covering this year. It is The Caves of Treasure Island by Paul Braun and Jeffrey Gens. And thankfully, this one is pretty interesting.
I think this is the first time we've seen either of them as well. Make one. Maybe the first?
Yes. Yeah, and Paul Braun and Jeffrey Gens, this is their first appearance making a Eamon adventure. I believe they both go on to make another one on their own, but this is the only one that they do joint together. And part of the reason that this is the first time we're seeing them is because they wrote this when they were in either 9th or 10th grade.
Okay.
This is very much a Greg Hassett kind of thing where it's real young person making an adventure game. So, you know, there's going to be some weirdness and some strange logic in there. But honestly, I got to say, as I was playing through this, pretty impressed. Like, they did a pretty good job. Maybe it's because it was two of them putting their heads together. And apparently when they were doing this, they had 6 Eamon discs that they were like playing over and over again, tons and tons. And they were super into it. And that's why they made Caves of Treasure Island. But the tools for like a toolkit to make Eamon Adventures weren't even released yet. So they did it from scratch somehow. So pretty impressive. They were really determined to do this. And one of the defining features of this adventure is that, unlike most Eamon adventures, it has a map at the beginning of the game. As far as I can tell, you can't bring it up throughout the game, but it's still really nice that they give you a picture of Treasure Island and they show you, here's where you get dropped off, here's the volcano that you're going to have to explore, here's like some jungle and lakes and stuff where there's some points of interest. And then here's the other boat on the south shore where you go to escape. So, you know, it's really vague and it's not super detailed or anything, but it's just nice going into a text adventure, having that context. Because I actually felt like I knew like, oh, okay, like that's why the geography is the way it is. You know, I know what it makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah. It's like you want to go to the volcano. Okay. That's to the right or, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And I believe they had the map, you know, correctly relative of the cardinal directions. So it actually made sense that way as well. The story is also fairly interesting. It's a adventurer from the Adventurers Guild got captured by pirates, sent a message in the bottle that ended up at the tavern somehow. And the bottle, basically, he asked to be rescued, but while it was in the water, his name disappeared. So that's kind of one of the big puzzles of the game too, is there's multiple people you can save from these pirates, and you don't really know until you find him which one is the adventurer you're supposed to save. So getting into the gameplay of it, it's very similar to all the other Eamon adventures we've looked at. You have a text adventure sort of navigation and puzzle solving mixed with looting and leveling and RPG mechanics. Just like other adventures, there are NPCs in the world. Several of the NPCs, you can smile at them or say hello to them. And based on your charm stat, there's a chance that they will become your allies, follow you around, and help you in combat, which is something I loved about the first Eamon game that I played. And I loved it just as much here. It was great in my playthrough when I walked up to 2 cannibals and I was like, this isn't going to go great. So I just smiled at them and then they started fighting with me for the rest of the time. So I had my 2 cannibal buddies who helped me fight all the pirates. Right at the start, there's also a potion that has various effects, which honestly, because I didn't want to delete my character, I never drank, but apparently it can just do a bunch of random stuff to you. So I liked there's that addition. There's also some enemies that you fight that have unique items, which usually they kind of get simplified to bring on other adventures because like super unique named items don't really translate to other adventures well, but still just being able to get a magical axe and bring it back and use it on another adventure is super cool. And I also like the setting. You're navigating through caves under a volcano, fighting pirates, and figuring out which captive is the right adventurer before making your way to the southern ship to head home. So that's sort of the basic overview of the gameplay and some of the cool things about it. Let me get into my ratings now. For graphics, I gave it a 1.25 out of 10, which may not seem like much, but it is for the first time that I can actually give like a legitimate graphics rating for an Eamon adventure. The descriptions are pretty good, but that is no substitution for an actual map. It's super simple, but it's the version I was looking at, I believe, was on the Apple II. So it had, you know, a couple good colors in it and gave you good information about all the different areas of the island and where you need to go to leave. So I really appreciated that. Another unexpected category that I get to give points for is sounds, because there actually are sounds in this text adventure, believe it or not. I only gave it a 1 out of 10 because I said sounds plural, but I actually think it is only one sound, at least as far as I could tell. But it's a pretty cool one. What it is a flute that you can pick up during this adventure. You get it from killing a pirate. And whenever you use the flute, it actually plays a little like beeping tune of somebody playing a flute. And I just think it's so cool that it's contextual, like that it knows, okay, you played this instrument in the game, so now it's going to play a sound. And it's really cool, and you actually do use the flute to solve a puzzle, so it actually has a purpose other than just making music. It's a really neat idea, and I hope more text adventures kind of integrate that sort of stuff. Moving on to gameplay, I unfortunately only gave it a 2.5 out of 10 here. I mean, I am a big fan of the Eamon games and what they try to do, but it still kind of boils down to a text adventure a lot of the time and had a couple of instant death areas, which I hate in text adventures in general because then you have to start over. And I especially think it's harsh in the Eamon world where I might not understand the rules totally, but I'm pretty sure if they die, you kind of lose your character. There may be saving or something, I'm not sure, but like these are characters that you build up over multiple campaigns. So if you just lose them in one fell swoop from a instant death, that's not a good feeling. Thankfully, I didn't lose my character, and I actually had to play this on a sort of demo version with a demo character. So it didn't end up being a character I had too much attachment to anyway. But because I had read that there were instant deaths in this, I was playing super safe, and I feel like that kind of defeats the purpose. You know, I knew there were instant kills, and I didn't like rush into danger because I was scared of losing a character. So I just don't like that in this type of game. I will say that they were fairly well signposted and like pointed out. Like it would say, you hear the rumbling of tigers over there, and if you go over there, you die instantly to tigers. So like... Most of them were pretty well pointed out, but still, I just think it's a weird idea for this type of game, so I did have to knock the gameplay a little bit for that. Other than that, though, I think the Caves of Treasure Island is a pretty fun, solid Eamon adventure. It was a little bit light on the puzzles, and the puzzle with like finding the right adventurer to solve is more just finding a secret area, and then once you find him, he says, I'm the person you're trying to find. And you're like, oh, okay, cool. So that doesn't end up being that much of like a mental game to figure out. But it also had a good bit of combat, which I enjoyed. Valuables to collect, which I always love, especially when they're cool weapons I can take back. And I really liked the fun theming of this island with a volcano that you can go into the caves under the volcano and find this big pirate base. So overall, you know, it didn't have all the cool gameplay stuff I was hoping for, but it was still a super solid Eamon adventure. And then for relevance, I gave it a 6 out of 10. It's the only Eamon game that we're going to be covering this year, and I do think it's definitely the most relevant of them all for introducing graphics and sound to the genre. That's pretty big for a text adventure, and even though this game is pretty small and I don't think, you know, many people other than the Eamon community know about it, I do think it deserves a little bit of relevance for that. And so overall, that left me with a 2 out of 10 for the Caves of Treasure Island. It's a fun little adventure in the Eamon world with interesting puzzle premise of finding a lost adventurer and a cool setting. The instant deaths sound a little bit rough to me, but I appreciate they were at least flagged fairly well and avoidable. And as with all the other Eamon games, I just love the fact that you can level up your characters, sell the stuff that you found, and go on a new adventure.
Nice. Cool. Yeah, I'm glad we got to check out at least one of them this year.
Yeah.
but there was a lot more than one. I thought that one was the best one. It was actually the very first one that came out this year. When we were looking at these to see which ones were the good ones, we used the aim and resources that we had available, and most of these other ones just didn't have a lot of good things to say about them. So we're like, we don't have to do those. But the other Aemon adventures that came out this year, all the way through the end of the year, we had one called Furioso, one called Hero's Castle, The Caves of Mondamin, Merlin's Castle, Hogarth Castle, Death Trap, The Black Death, and The Quest for Meron. And again, most of those, we don't really know a whole lot about them. There was a lot of new authors in that list, though, including probably the biggest guy of them all, a guy named John Nelson, who goes on to create some 20 Aemon adventures over the next several years and start the National Aemon Users Club and the Aemon Adventures Log newsletter, which I think is still a community that's going today. So he's definitely someone we're going to be watching out for. I think he came out with five. He came out with five this year, but I guess his earlier ones weren't the best.
Yeah, well, hey, if he's like a champion for the community, hopefully we're going to get some good stuff from him eventually.
Yeah.
All right, now let's move on to some other honorable mentions. We have some game books from 1981 that didn't end up being too important. Most of them, you know, they end up just printing shorter games, kind of like easy stuff to type in. So they're all pretty limited. And I'm just going to mention a few because there are a lot of these, but we have things like the HP 85 Games Pack by HP, the Mostly Basic Applications for Your TRS-80 Volume 2 by Howard Barenboim. We have the 50 Rip-Roaring Games for the CX-80 and CX-81 by Database Consultancy. We didn't find them nearly as rip-roaring as they said they were. Also, Microcosm 1 by Basics and Beyond Incorporated. And Not Only 30 Programs for the Sinclair ZX81 by Acme. And there were a couple more in there as well.
Yep, but if you want to know the full list, again, it'll be on our website in the sources section. Just look for the Excel sheet. But moving on, we have another list here that, again, I'm not going to name out all these because there's so many. But this was kind of my miscellaneous list. Basically, any game we found that was on a piece of hardware where, like, in total there was like five or less games for that piece of hardware, I put them on this list. I just call it like miscellaneous games on smaller computers or systems. The systems in question are like mainframe computers, the Play-Doh Network, Xerox Alto, Wang 2200, the PDP computers. There was even some homebrews for the APF Imagination Machine.
Year,
but none of these are very good, though. Like, a lot of them are just black and white, text-based, don't run well. They're not the big computers, and they just don't run very well. So nothing of note there, but just, you know, if you think, oh, there's a game for the Wing 2200, are they going to mention it? It's going to be in that list. So.
All right, and then we have some games specifically for the Ohio Scientific computer that weren't too interesting, but we still wanted to mention. We have Circle World by Bob Anderson, Invaders by Premier Publications, Labyrinth by Aardvark Technical Services, Breakout by Ohio Scientific, Torpedo by Ohio Scientific, Space War by Ohio Scientific, and a couple more that we, again, will have listed on our website.
Mm-hmm. Just going through all of our, you know, checklists here. Mm-hmm. We've got another list here called, I called it, Clones of Pre-1981 Arcade Games. Because there's a lot of games that come out in 81 that we've already seen. Stuff like Clones of Phoenix, Clones of Pac-Man, Clones of Star Castle. Tons of different stuff. But we've seen them all before. And none of these clones did anything new. They're just straight up ripoffs. So, I thought, we don't need to cover these arcade games. We'll put those ones to the side. We've seen them. So, again, that huge list, it's on our website.
And then one final big list we have here of 1981 casino and board game arcade games. There are rare occasions that we want to take a look at these when they're really, really good and they have great graphics or great gameplay. But for the most part, we've seen all of these before. You know, there are things like poker or mahjong or different card games and things like that, and not always stuff that we're particularly interested in reviewing. So again, we will have a list of all those games up on our website.
All right, but let's move on to actual real arcade games that we do want to cover now. We've got an honorable mention here called Space Echo by Gaten Games. It's a clone of Space Rescue, which was a Galaxian-style game where aliens came down from the top and then, like, took sprites of people from a world that was on, like, the corner of the screen and, like, grabbed them and tried to run away with the people and you know, shoot them down before they did that. Space Echo is a clone of that, and the gameplay is identical, but it has a brand new background with new artwork resembling New York City, which actually looks really good. So it's like in full color, and it's pretty nice to look at, but the gameplay is identical to something we've already seen.
And then we also have R2D Tank, aka Red Tank Part 2 by Sigma and Ventureline Incorporated. This was some sort of tank slash maybe Pac-Man clone, but it didn't look very good. So we at least wanted to mention it, but not something we wanted to review.
It was weird. Like, you had to pick up dots on the field, and then that would become your ammo to shoot. Kind of interesting, but the background was, like, black with a bunch of dots, and there was no walls or anything.
Like, oh, boy.
All right, but with that being said, Wes, we're moving officially into February for 1981.
Ooh, yeah.
And we only have time to do one game here. My last review of the day for February of 1981, but there's a whole lot of really, really good ones I'm keeping for later. So next week will be a pretty big one. But for this week, I just wanted to do kind of a medium-sized game here. It's called World War III by IREM, and it came out in February of 1981. It's a Galaxian-type game with a bunch of different phases, although I didn't actually play that one. The reason why I didn't play World War III by IREM is because there's no videos of the original cabinet, and all the emulation has no sound, but there's a clone of this game called Red Alert by GIC, which was just the United States release of this game. Came out a couple months later, but it's essentially the identical game, and it did have some sound effects. So I actually played that one, but, you know, for all intents and purposes, it's World War III by IREM, and this one's pretty cool. There's a lot going on. I think the gameplay is maybe a little stale, but I really like the story and like background kind of behind this game. Basically, I don't know who you're defending the world against, but there's some sort of enemy invasion happening, and you're tasked with defending, I guess, allied countries from invasion. And whenever you do that, whenever you go into a level, there's three phases to the level. The first phase is you're at the bottom of the screen. It's very much like a Space Invaders or Galaxian game where you're just moving horizontal across the bottom and shooting up. But the enemies are these jet planes that will fire down bombs and also do some different bombing run patterns, you know, just like in Galaxian. But it's kind of like they're in a big group like that you would expect from a Galaxian or Space Invaders, but they all fly across the screen pretty fast and then outside of your range and kind of fly past where the screen stops, so you have no enemies on screen, and then they make another run the other way or back and forth. So they're kind of flying in and out of the screen as a group, and then there's a couple that will fly down at you and leave the group to do that. But basically, you've got these jet fighters that you're shooting down, but there's a little bit of a twist. There is a timer at the top that starts at, I think, 7 a.m., and you have to shoot down these 20 jet fighters by the time the timer gets to 11 a.m. If you do not do that, you get an extra phase where the enemy, I guess, essentially launches like a nuke, and then you have to shoot down the nuke. When you hit it, it divides into two nukes, and when you hit those two nukes, they divide into two more nukes.
Oh, God.
It's really, really hard. But essentially, if any of the nukes hit the ground, you lose a life. So it's kind of like this little boss phase that only happens if you don't kill the 20 jet fighters. But let's say, you know, we kill the 20 jet fighters, we're on to the next phase. Or we didn't, but we survived or just lost one life in the nuke phase, and we're on to the next phase. Phase 2 is a phase where you have to defend against helicopters. And I say that a little hesitantly because, I mean, I guess they're helicopters, but they look pretty weird, these helicopters. They move very fast, which I'm not accustomed to with helicopters. And the helicopters, instead of dropping bombs, they actually drop parachute troopers. And the parachute troopers can hit you, but they can also just kind of block you from moving horizontally as well, because they kind of chill out at the bottom just for a little bit. So they're very dangerous. And again, I think if you don't kill all the helicopters by a certain time, then the nuke phase happens. But let's say, okay, we got through the helicopter phase, then we're on to the final phase, which is back to the jets, except this time they're moving a lot slower horizontally across the screen, and not so much in a big group, more just like a shooting gallery kind of thing. But it's nighttime, because you're fighting through an entire day here. It's kind of the premise. So it's nighttime, and you have like the headlight mechanic of driving in a tunnel for our driving games, where there's these two essentially spotlights lighting up the sky, and you only see the jets in that little zone, and whenever the jets are not in that zone, they're hidden in darkness. And that looks really good. I really like that. It's a nice phase. The jets, they don't have any real tricks to them. So I think of the three phases, actually the easiest phase. Like, the gameplay is not super great, but the visuals are really cool. And then when you survive that phase and you kill all the jets, maybe the nuke again, it says peace forever, but then you go on to the next mission, which is like the first mission you have to defend France. The second mission you have to defend, I think, the United States, and all three waves start up again. But because you're in the United States now, the background is very slightly different to resemble a skyline of New York City rather than like a skyline of Paris. But the gameplay is identical. The background just changes slightly. And then, let's say you go through another three phases. I think you go to the UK, and then Germany, and then Japan, and then it goes back to Paris. So, it's like 15 total waves if you wanted to do the full thing. It's a pretty intense game with a lot of stuff going on, and a lot of stuff that's pretty cool. So, with all that being said, let me get into my ratings for it. For gameplay, I ended up giving this a 3 out of 10. The gameplay is actually, I think, maybe one of the more worst parts about this game. Like, it's good. It's really good. But the enemies kind of don't really do anything that interesting. Even the nuke mechanic sounds cool until you play it and you realize it's just, like, impossible. Like, it's just not tuned well at all. I found the helicopter phase to be impossible. I never got through that. The first phase is hard, but it's very doable. And I think the third phase would be doable as well. But the difficulties is just horrible in this game. I don't know how they would expect anybody to actually play it. The only person I saw go through all the phases had an invincibility cheat on. That's why he was able to do it. But it's just not tuned well. It just doesn't feel that good to play. It feels overly hard. The shooting down of enemies in a Galaxian style, I'm always a big fan of that. But, you know, it didn't do anything too crazy in terms of the gameplay. There's no, like, real boss phase. You could kind of call the nuke a boss phase, but it doesn't feel like that. And I would say most of the other phases feel just unfair. So it wasn't the best. And the fact that you have a timer just makes it all even worse, knowing that if you don't shoot everything down in a certain amount of time, that the nuke's coming and you're almost assured to lose a life at that point, you end up making a lot more mistakes. So that was kind of the main detractor from it, just it being too difficult, but it was fun to shoot down all these different things. I think the gameplay kind of gets overshadowed by what this game does really well, which is the graphics. I gave that a 3.75 out of 10 because I think the graphics of this look really nice. The enemy jets and helicopters look really good. They're all multicolored sprites and usually have like maybe three colors or four colors in the sprites. I just think they look really nice. I really enjoyed the enemies. But then again, what you're shooting them with, I don't know what that is. It looks like a turret or something. It looks horrible, though. Like your ship or defensive gun, I guess. That does not look good. But then you've got the backgrounds, which change for all the locations you go to. right? There's a different background for America and Germany and the UK and France and I think Italy and Japan, and they all look amazing, but they're only in one color. They're not in multicolor, which would have been great. And also the skylines, they only make up maybe like 10% of the screen. I guess they wanted you to feel like you're really shooting very high into the sky when you're shooting these planes. So the skyline ends only maybe 20% up the screen, and most of the screen is just a black or a kind of a blank blue gray color. So that part of the screen doesn't change between levels. So there's some really good stuff or some really bad, or not really bad, but just kind of not as good stuff. The fighting at night with the moving spotlights, that looks awesome. I really love that. You can't control the spotlights, but just them moving around and the way that they do is really cool, and I love that mechanic. I don't think we've ever seen that in a Galaxian game, but it totally fits because you're fighting at night. Also, for all the different phases, because you're fighting quote-unquote throughout the day, there is a red one color circle on the screen that slowly moves to represent the sun as passes. So that was cool, but it doesn't look like the sun. It's like a dark red color. I don't know. The color palette didn't make as much sense for that. You also have some clouds, but they never change. And one of my favorite parts is whenever you go from city to city, there's like a little, not cutscene, but it kind of transitions to like a world map. And then it's like, you know, now you're going to Italy, and it kind of highlights Italy on the map. And I thought that whole thing was really well done. It kind of gives just a little bit of a break before that next wave. And it's really cool. So the graphics I really liked, although I feel like there was so much potential for them to be even better had they had multicolored skylines for all the different cities, or just a little bit more going on in the background above the cities, having your ship look cooler. Like, there are some things I definitely wanted more of, but what we got is really good. So graphics of this are pretty cool. For sound, I know I said that the version I played had sound, but it only had a couple sounds, so I didn't feel comfortable giving it a rating because your shooting sound, for instance, wasn't emulated. The only sounds that were emulated were an explosion sound, and I don't know how authentic that is. But the other sounds that were emulated on this one, which is the main reason I wanted to play the clone, is that there's digitized voice in this, and the digitized voice is kind of like a military commander kind of like prepping you for the mission or something. Oh, nice. It's like, you know, yeah. 20 aircraft approaching, take cover or get ready or something like that. So it happens only at the start of each of the levels, but it's really well done. It actually sounds really good for digitized speech, I think. Doesn't sound very robotic at all. It sounds like a human almost. So I wanted to point that out, but I didn't end up rating it just because of that one sound, because I couldn't really be fair. So skip that one.
Red fighters approaching. Destroy all fighters by 1100 hours or MER will be launched. Red alert. Enemy aircraft approaching. Land. Red alert. Night attack by bombers.
For relevance, I don't know. I give it a 5.5 out of 10. IREM is not a huge company, but you know, they do make their own games pretty often, and they're not horrible. Because I couldn't find any like physical cabinets of this anywhere, any videos or anything, I thought it's probably not that relevant or didn't sell that well. However, I think there's a lot of really cool mechanics going on in this game that we haven't really seen before, like time passing, nighttime in a Galaxian game, different levels, like going from France to the United States to the UK to Italy and all this stuff. So I think there's some really cool mechanical improvements that we haven't really seen. But then again, the game didn't sell. So I ended up right about 5.5 out of 10. I thought that was maybe fair for relevance. And overall, I gave it a 3.5 out of 10. It's quite good. I think with this being only February, by the time we finish 81, this won't look as good. But for right now where we are, I think it's quite good. The graphics are really, really nice. Not like the best of all time, but really nice. Gameplay is pretty cool. It has unique mechanics. There's just a couple faults with it and with how hard it is. And, you know, the fact that the enemies always look the same between France and the UK and act the same. And it's always the same rounds over and over. But a lot of good stuff here that I really enjoyed. So, yeah, that's World War III by IREM, also known as Red Alert by GIC Incorporated. So, our last two of the day.
Very cool. Yeah, I mean, definitely sounds like it has like its issues. And, you know, maybe they had issues with the implementation of some of their ideas. But I love that theming of like over the course of a day and the, you know, theater of war changing and stuff like that. It's definitely got some really unique ideas in there.
Yeah. So that's going to do it for us today. I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. We covered Monkey by VTech, a new competitor to the Game & Watch franchise. I covered Roach Hotel, where you launched your foot at roaches on Apple II. Quested the Caves of Treasure Island on the Amon system. And then finally, I did World War III by IREM for the arcades. So it was a pretty nice, pretty fun one today. So,
yeah.
I enjoyed it for sure.
Me too. And we are starting in February, as Ben mentioned, of 1981. So we are going to keep going through this year. We got so much more fun stuff to cover. And if you want to keep following us on this journey, which I hope you do, make sure to check out our website where we've got lots more information about different developers, games, and stuff that we've covered before. Also follow us on Twitter, where we post announcements. And if you have any questions, feel free to send us an email.
And with that, we'll catch you next time.
See you all next time.